It's kind of like, you know, getting a new toy or buying a new outfit or clothing or something like that. Whenever I start a new book in the Bible, it's kind of like, all right, what's this got? And then you say, well, that's weird. You've been preaching for like, you know, 180 years. You've been through everything a couple times, right? Well, it's close. Actually, 16 years ago, I did a walkthrough one Wednesday night per of the Minor Prophets. And 9 years ago, according to my records, Rory preached through the Minor Prophets one sermon per on Sunday nights. So we've done, in the last 20 years, two that I have record of, quick walks through the Minor Prophets. excuse me, sorry about that. Get rid of the crud and maybe it'll be okay. I've purposed to take for the next time a series of Minor Prophets walks. There's 14 chapters in the book of Hosea, and I have currently scheduled 7 sermons. So from now until with the Christmas breaks, from now until the end of January, we'll be in the book of Hosea. Minor Prophets are a section at the end of your Old Testament, and probably many times when somebody, you're listening to preaching and somebody says, turn to the book of Habakkuk, and you go, Habakkuk, yeah. And it's in there, right? I know it's in there. Let's see. And maybe you refer back to your Sparky days, those of you who grew up in Awana, and you try to say the books of the Old Testament fast and figure out where Habakkuk is. Well, the Minor Prophets, that's a term that's being used to talk about a section in our Bible, and actually that term goes back over 1,500 years, this group in books within Christendom. This book in the Old Testament was called the Minor Prophets. We call them Minor Prophets. There's two reasons. One, that traditionally the Jews put all 12 of these books on one scroll. So they may have had a scroll for Isaiah with its 66 chapters and a scroll for Jeremiah with its 50 chapters, a large scroll again for Ezekiel. Daniel would have been on its own scroll. Daniel's only 12 chapters, so it's a little smaller, but because of the prestige of Daniel and the importance of that book, it would be maybe on a separate scroll. But these 12, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, they were all on one scroll. Another might be that they were called minor prophets, maybe because they're just smaller. Two of them, Zechariah and Hosea, have 14 chapters. Obadiah has one. Most of the rest have two or three. Three or four is probably the most common number of chapters. So perhaps again, that's why we call them the minor prophets. As you look at the minor prophets, next slide has it kind of grouped them. This is just the minor prophets. So Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel are not listed here. You can divide prophets into a couple different ways of thinking about them. One way is to divide them according to who they were written to, as in what country. If you remember, Saul, David, Solomon were all kings of Israel. And then Solomon's son, Rehoboam, was not a bright boy. And he allowed the kingdom to be divided through his own arrogance. And so Jeroboam, his dad's former servant, becomes king up north. And Jeroboam takes the 10 northern tribes, sometimes we call it that way. The northern tribes went by names like Samaria, Ephraim, here in the book of Hosea. Sometimes they were just called Israel, the tribes in the north were called that. The northern kingdom, Jezreel, sometimes was a name given to the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom, which is two tribes, Judah and Benjamin, were usually called after David's tribe by the name of Judah. So we have the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. So one question to ask yourself is, to whom did this prophet write? And as you look at this chart, you see that they have listed here the three books, Jonah, Amos, and Hosea, that were to the north. Now, what makes Hosea a little bit unique is that Hosea is the only northerner who actually ministered to the north. Amos, he was a southerner. He was from the other side of the Dixie line. And he went up and ministered to people just across the border. He didn't get as far as Samaria. Jonah was a northerner, but of course God didn't send him to Israel. God sent him to the enemy. God sent him to the Assyrian capital of Nineveh during a time when the Assyrians were really shaking things up. So Hosea is kind of unique in that he is the only prophet that was sent from the north to minister to the people in the north. He was a Samaritan, if you will, being asked to minister in the city of Samaria. That was a different thing, considering all the other books in the Old Testament. Another way to think about the prophets, and this chart does that, is to talk about, were they pre-exilic, exilic, or post-exilic? Now you say, what in the world does that mean? Well, you all remember that the northern kingdom is taken into Assyria, where they were captured and then assimilated into different cultures, and some of them went back and became the Samaritans that in Jesus' day they stayed away from. So that happened in 722 BC, but about 250 years or so after Solomon died. And then in the south, they went into exile about 600 BC, or about 400 years after Solomon and after the kingdom was divided after the death of Solomon. So if a prophet preached pre-exilic, in other words, before the north went into Assyria, before Nebuchadnezzar took the south into Judah, what would their message be about? Well, it'd be a wet message of warning. Hey, if you guys don't straighten up, I'm going to come in there and spank you all, right? Now, once they were taken to exile, what would the message be? Well, read the prophet, one that's not listed here that was pre-exilic is Isaiah. But if you read the book of Jeremiah, especially the book of Ezekiel, the book of Daniel, those are exilic prophets, the major prophets, those Ezekiel, Daniel, Jeremiah. And their message is one of warning, kind of, you guys better straighten up because this is actually happening. But then there's a message of hope. There's a message of God is going to do something. God is not done yet. God is going to use you even after he spanks you. God is going to restore a relationship with you, and God's not done yet. And then the last group of prophets are post-exilic. They all ministered in the south. There was no post-exilic Israel in the north. That's why sometimes they're called the lost tribes, but believe me, they're not lost. God knows who they are and where they are. The post-exilic prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, they ministered to people that came back from Babylon, and their message, of course, was one of, see, God did what he said, now you need to do what you need to do. And it was a message of restoration. It was a message of hope. So as we look at the minor prophets, or we look at any of the prophets, we have to ask ourselves some questions. To whom was it written, north or south? When was it written? Is it pre-exilic, exilic, or post-exilic? And then what was going on there at the time? Hosea it was kind of unique. The next slide is a timeline. Hosea had a long ministry. This timeline shows Hosea, and I know you can't see it maybe real well, but the numbers at the top way at the start with David and Solomon's ministry about 1000 AD, and they end way over on the right at about 500. So this is about 500 years of what was going on in this part of the world. So you have the kings, you have the Assyrian kings, the Babylonian kings, the kings of Judah, and the kings of Israel in the north, or Samaria in the north. Probably the most important thing to look at is the top line, the prophets to Israel. And you see that Elijah and Elisha, you remember those guys, the miracle workers who confronted kings, but they never wrote anything. They ministered in the north. And in the same vein with them were Jonah, Amos, and then Hosea. Hosea, if you look just underneath there, you'll see Jeroboam the second. There was the original Jeroboam. He was Solomon's servant who becomes king. And God promised him that if he would serve God, that he would have a perpetual kingdom. Well, instead, he invents a religion. You know, you got to be pretty arrogant to think that people should worship you. You got to be pretty arrogant to say, you know, what's been going on for the last 500 years was all wrong. Let's start something new. And what Jeroboam does is he kind of marries the local old Canaanite Baal worship and the worship of Jehovah God. He kind of puts them together. Now, if I said to my wife, I'm kind of going to be married to you, and that's all good, but I'm kind of also going to be married to two or three other women, is that okay? That's kind of what's going on here. When you're worshiping Jehovah God, but not just Jehovah God, you're also worshiping kind of a modified form of Baal worship. And you're also worshiping a modified, and that's exactly what Jeroboam did. He says, we're going to still worship God, but we're going to do it. We're going to use this golden calf down in Bethel and another golden calf up in Dan. And go there, worship Jehovah, but go to these places and do it. Well, that infected the land of Samaria, Israel, and for their whole tenure, the next 200 years, they are in a state of syncretism and confusion as they have both the God worship and also the worship of these false gods. I'll talk more about that as we get to the end of the sermon today. So notice that Hosea starts about the time Jeroboam II is ending his ministry according to this timeline or his kingship. Look down the next line and see the kings of Judah. And if you can't read it, I'll tell you what's there. Notice it says Uzziah. Remember from Isaiah chapter 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. Uzziah, good king, right? Friend of Isaiah's. Uzziah. And then it mentions Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. I'm referring back to what Charlie read in Hosea 1:1. So he lists four kings in Judah, only one up in Israel. Hosea lived in Israel. Why did he only name one king, Jeroboam II, Jeroboam, in Israel, and he names four kings where he's not ministering, where he's not living down in Judah? Well, three of the four guys down in Judah, except for Ahaz, three of the four, the book of Chronicles says, did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord. So they were godly kings, basically. And maybe that's one reason. Maybe Hosea thought they were legitimate kings because they were all descendants of David. Up in the north, the story goes like this. There was this there was Jeroboam, and then he had a couple sons that reigned on the throne. And then there comes in this Omni guy, and he was very wicked, and his son Ahab, ooh, boo, real bad guy, right? Well, the prophet Elijah prophesied that God would completely destroy the whole house of Ahab. And he did that with an army captain by the name of Jehu. You remember that? Jehu was told by a servant of Elisha, not Elijah, that was the guy that confronted Ahab. He was told by a servant of Elisha that he was going to be the king, and he was anointed king. Well, Jehu took his job of cleaning house very seriously, maybe too seriously. Not only did he wipe out the house of Ahab, and so that every male that belonged to Ahab's lineage was killed, just like the prophet Elijah said would happen, but he also killed some of them that were related to and had married into the house of David and wiped out them too. God promised Jehu, just like he did Jeroboam the first, that if he would dedicate himself to God, that God would give him a perpetual lineage, that he would always have someone on the throne. Three of Jehu's descendants ended up on the throne of Israel. But he did not do what God said. And the bottom line was Jeroboam II, the guy that's still reigning when Hosea begins his ministry, was the last. He perpetuated the Baal Jehovah syncretism that started during the days of Jeroboam I. During the days of Jeroboam II, they did well. There was wealth. There was peace. There was decent diplomatic relationships with Judah and with Assyria, the people on the north and south of them. Did I say they were wealthy? They were wealthy. They really had anything and everything they wanted as far as they knew. I mean, they didn't have, you know, internet and all that, you know, but as far as they knew, they had it all there in downtown Samaria. But the truth of the matter is, they were theologically and spiritually a mess. And during this period of time, God sent... Now, why didn't Hosea mention the 6-7 kings that followed Jeroboam II? During most of the 40 to 60 years, depending on who you read, that Hosea was ministering, those guys were the king there in Samaria. I think it's probably because they were all wicked. And in Hosea's mind, they were all illegitimate as far as kings were concerned. One more note with this timeline, and then we'll go on. Notice that one of the guys that Hosea mentions was Hezekiah. Hezekiah, he's the guy that comes in after his dad was wicked, and he cleans house in Judah and destroys all the idol worship that's going on. And Hezekiah ministered or was the king in Judah after Samaria was taken captive. And so the king of Assyria, anybody confused yet? The king of Assyria came down to Samaria and destroyed Hosea's hometown, took everybody away. But Hosea said he ministered during that time, during the time of King Hezekiah. After that happened, it kind of gives me the opinion that maybe Hosea moved. Maybe Hosea knew that the king of Assyria was coming down, that he kind of was forewarned. Imagine God telling his prophet something like that. And maybe he decided to become a southerner and go down to Judah and fellowship with Isaiah and the boys down there under that good King Hezekiah's life. And so perhaps Hosea was able to experience what happened in his hometown or the judgments. Let me get back to the text, or get to the text. That's kind of an introduction of what's going on. We're going to look at some names here. Let me read again the word of the Lord that came to Hosea. I'm in the book of Hosea, the son of Beeri. In the days of Uzziah, good king in Judah, Jotham, good king in Judah, Ahaz, bad king in Judah, and Hezekiah, Ahaz's son, good guy in Judah that held the revival. Kings of Judah in the days of Jeroboam, that should be would be Jeroboam II, the son of Joash, a fourth generation descendant of the man who drove his chariot furiously, Jehu. When the Lord began to speak by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord." It's kind of a duh to come up with the theme of the book of Hosea. Anybody who would read the book of Hosea, very quickly, starting right here, goes, okay, I know what's going on. We've got God telling Hosea to be like he is, God, and that he's supposed to marry a woman who's a harlot, who is going to represent Israel and their departure from God. And truly, if you read the rest of the book, that's it. That's the theme. God plays the role of, Hosea plays the role of God, and Gomer, she's going to play the role of an unfaithful people. Some look at this story and they go, not true. No, no. Nice analogies, good story, and even some Bible believers would say this. Nice story, it's all allegorical, it didn't really happen. And their big problem with it really happening is the idea that God would tell his prophet to go marry a whore. Go marry this woman with this reputation. Because if you look at 2:1 and later, it sure seems like that's what God says. Therefore, they also take it the little sketches, the biographical sketches, and perhaps you discern some of them as this was read. But in the first three chapters, there's references to things happening in Hosea's life, like his son being born, okay? And they say all those too are just allegorical. Most Bible believers, and I say, that there really was this relationship between Hosea and Gomer, and there really were children named Jezreel, Loruhamah, and Lo-Ami that really happened, and that God used a real-life story to be a very powerful message to his people and to us today. So you say, well, then what happened? Did Hosea really marry somebody who already had the reputation of being a harlot? I mean, was she a harlot first and everybody knew it and then Hosea married her? Or did Hosea marry a girl and God knew that she would become a harlot? Well, we'll talk a little bit about the theology of that next week. For our purposes, my answer would be, does it really matter how it happened? I mean, in our legalistic mind, we may think it has to be one way or another, but I'll challenge some of that thinking perhaps next week as we go from the book of Hosea's side. Let's talk about these names and the people involved, and then we'll get into an outline. And, you know, normally my sermons are about 12 pages. This one is 17. Hang on, we're about halfway already. Names. Hosea means the Lord saves. One commentator said this is the second greatest story in all the Bible. The first greatest, of course, being the story of Jesus coming for us. Both are stories of love and redemption. Gomer, the guy that, the woman that Hosea was told to marry, I wish we knew more about her. Her name means completion. Completion. And maybe God, through her parents, was pointing out the fact that God's patience with Samaria was coming to an end. She was the daughter of a guy named Diblaim, D-I-B-L-A-I-M. One commentator said that his name meant double layers of grape cake. Yeah, I don't know if he was a baker or if his mom liked that when she was pregnant or what the deal was, but double layers of grape cake. Anyway, we're going to come back to her for the outline. Let me read about this next person, Jezreel. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the blood of Jezreel on the house of Jehu, and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Jezreel is a city. Jezreel is also the name of a valley. It's a city where Jehu will destroy the remnant of Ahab's seed. It's the city where Naboth, remember Naboth, the Jezreelite, the guy that Ahab had put to death? It was his hometown. And so Jehu will come in and destroy Ahab's seed. He will also destroy dozens of others of descendants of King David. He will decimate the city's royalty. And the people remember this. And it is Jehu, the guy that did this, it's his great-great-grandson, or his great-grandson, rather, that's sitting on the throne right now, Jeroboam II. And so God says to Hosea, name your first son, your firstborn son, Jezreel, after this city, because I'm about to revenge what Jehu did in that city. Would you want to name your kid that? You know, I grew up in the Cold War. Nobody I knew named their kid Moscow. You know, maybe a dog, you might give a name like that. Why? They were our enemies. Or nobody named it after something terrible. You know, remember after the April 19th, my birthday, we had the Waco disaster. Again, Waco is not a place where you don't like that name anymore because of the terrible things that happened there. So he names his firstborn son Jezreel, reminding everybody who would know Jezreel about what God did or what God was going to do to revenge this. The Valley of Jezreel is also another name for another part of that same valley as the Valley of Armageddon. So God was going to revenge what Jehu did in the city of Jezreel, in the Valley of Jezreel, and will someday revenge Israel of all its enemies in that same valley. Great name for a son, right? What do you think Gomer thought when Hosea named her firstborn son that name? Next child was a daughter. God told Hosea to name her Not Loved. Imagine looking at that little baby girl and saying, you are not pitied. You are not loved. God specifically says, let me read from verses 6 and 7, and she conceived again and bore a daughter. Then God said to him, call her name Loruhamah. For I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. Yet I will have mercy on the house of Judah, will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, or battle, by horses or horsemen. So God says he will have mercy to the south, but not to the northern kingdom. Notice in this text that Jezreel was the son of Hosea and Gomer. But it says of Loruhamah that she conceived. Doesn't necessarily say that Hosea was the father. Look at chapter 2, verse 4. Hosea is speaking here, and he says, I will not have mercy on her children, for they are the children of harlotry. For their mother has played the harlot. She who has conceived them has behaved shamefully. I think that Hosea is home taking care of little Jezreel, and Mama's out. And when Mama gets pregnant by somebody else, that Hosea takes care of the little baby girl and calls her not loved. A third child, a son, again. This time, I don't also believe it was Hosea's son. And God tells Hosea to name this second son, this third child, not my people. Let me read again from chapter 1, verse 8 and 9. Now when she had weaned Loruhamah, she conceived and bore a son, and God said, call his name Lo-Ammi, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. We'll talk about Hosea more next week. I believe that Hosea took care of children who were not his, children of his wife's adulterous relationships. In verses 2 to 4 of chapter 2, I don't think here he's telling Hosea, Gomer, go away. I think he's telling his kids to go beg for their mother to come home. And I think she's telling the natural consequences of the kind of sin. Bring charges against your mother, bring charges, for she is not my wife, nor am I her husband, lest let her put away her harlotries from her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and expose her as in the day that she was born, and make her like a wilderness and set her in a dry land and slay her with thirst. I will come back this morning. What I want to do is focus on Gomer. You know, when somebody knows God and chooses to go away from God, they believe a lie. Remember the garden? Here Eve is. And God says to Eve, who knew God, right? She had walked with God. She knew the Creator God. Eve did. And God says to Eve, or Satan says to Eve, did God really say that? And the Bible says when she saw that, she believed Satan's lies. And I would propose to you this morning that, like Gomer, we separate ourselves from God because we believe lies of our own making. Number one, and I'll hurry, we leave God when we seek contentment and physical pleasure. When we seek contentment, she says in verse 5, I will go after my lovers. But note the result of this. In verse 7, it says, she will chase her lovers, but not overtake them. I don't know Gomer's childhood. Did she come from a godly home or one that had adopted the hybrid religion of Jeroboam? I don't know. Was she part of her home, part of Elijah's remnant? Or had her family become more like the Assyrians? Had Gomer willingly married Hosea, knowing that he was a man of God? Or was it an arranged marriage that she had little or nothing to do with? We don't know these things. But one thing I do know, Gomer knew who God was, and Gomer knew that Hosea was his faithful man. And the text says that she behaved shamefully and went after her lovers. This was not a mistake. She didn't, as Galatians 5:1, we were there not too long ago, she wasn't overtaken in a trespass. She didn't one day just wake up and find herself in another man's bed. That's not what happened. She made choices against God. She thought the best pleasures would be found in lovers other than Hosea. And it was embracing this lie that was her choice. We leave God when we seek contentment and physical pleasures. Whenever we think, you know, I have a choice here between God and doing what my body wants. What is the real source of lasting contentment? What is the real source of true peace and rest? Where can we find eternal satisfaction? I hope you know the answer to these questions to be rhetorical. The answer is Jesus. There is nothing anyplace else. But notice, it says again in verse 7, she will chase her lovers will not overtake them. Yes, she will seek them, but not find them. Here she had something from God, and she ran away from it, choosing something that she thought would be better. The grass wasn't greener. She found a similar or worse emptiness. Like Gomer, we separate ourselves from God because we believe lies of our own making. Number one, we leave God when we seek contentment in physical pleasures. I think number two, we leave God when we seek contentment in physical, material things. In material things. Notice in verse 5, she says of her lovers, they gave me bread and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. I got this. I got this. Perhaps Gomer thought she could sleep her way to success. Perhaps she thought that fulfillment was found in experiences and events and things and thrills. Notice she says in verse 12, these are the wages that my lovers have given me. Again, I say, starting in Eden, Satan has always been a liar. He always says to us that experiencing, having, and being whatever you want to be, that is life. Experiencing, having, and being whatever you want, that is life. John, the old man, called it lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. See, the problem is, with any worship other than God, but especially with self-worship, there is a complete inability for it to be satisfied. If your God is pornography, you want another look. If your God is food, you always have to taste something else. If your God is beads and bling, you want more. And then you need a bigger place to put your beads and your bling. Notice the result of pursuing this lie. It says in verse 8, for she did not know that I gave her her grain, new wine and oil, and multiplied her silver and gold. Imagine how the story might have gone. The preacher in the streets of Samaria sees that his wife, in her current position as a temple prostitute or a motel whore, or maybe with the new Mr. Exciting, was not being taken care of. So he goes to his own bank, he goes to his own house. Maybe he gets her a new outfit, a new gown, some food that he knows she likes, money. I see the preacher of Samaria approach the pimp or the temple priest or whoever the most recent lover is. Perhaps Hosea knocks on the door. A man opens the door and is amazed to see the prophet, the real husband of the woman, sleeping it off in the back. The man, I'm sure, expects angry, biting words or maybe the swing of a club. Instead, he looks into the saddened eyes of Hosea and he hears a voice kindly say, you'll see that Gomer gets these, right? He mumbles, sure. And he looks in the bag and he sees the things that Gomer would be pleased to have. And he goes back and he presents them to Gomer. Maybe he fabricates some story about winning a good game at cards the night before. And he gives her what came from Hosea. He gives her the new gown. He gives her the food that she likes. And they take the money and they go out. And the Bible says they worship Baal. They have a good time on the money that came from the preacher. And the Bible says she didn't know. She didn't realize. She was ignorant enough, or she was duped enough by her own lust for the lies that she wanted to believe against God, that she thought that her sin was what was really making her happy and really giving her what she wanted. We leave God when we seek materialism. We seek comfort in material things. I see a rotten decay in verses 9 through 12. I'm not going to read it because my time is gone. I don't want a life without Jesus, for a life without Jesus is an ultimate destruction. Number 3. We leave God when we seek contentment in physical pleasures. We leave God when we seek contentment in material things. We leave God when we seek to replace him. You will worship something. Maybe your own fat, arrogant head. But you will worship something. Notice what happens in verse 8 and again in verse 13. He says after he gave her these things, which they prepared for Baal at the end of verse 8, and then I will punish her, for in the days of the Baals to which she burned incense, she decked herself with her earrings and jewelry and went after her lovers, but me she forgot, says the Lord. Number three, we leave God when we seek to replace him. She didn't just leave Hosea. She left her husband, her home, her children, but she left more than that. Gomer left God. Baal was molded as a man with a head and horns of an ox. He was the god of weather and fertility. The worship of one website I found said, this isn't a whole lot like today, unlike today. You know, we gather in large groups to watch people gyrate and take their clothes off and have public sex. You know, theater screens and things like that. Well, you know, that's exactly what the worship of Baal was. His worship featured sometimes human sacrifice, but more often public sex and temple prostitution between characters that were pretending to be Baal and Asherah. We will replace God with something else. If we don't, you know, last week's Sunday morning sermon was a little harsh for some. But listen to this part of it. God owns all your time, right? Does he not? Does he not own all of your life? And is there not a pattern of God saying, in the garden, this tree is mine, don't touch it. This city of Jericho is mine, don't touch it. This ox is mine, it belongs to me. And so, is not it right that a portion of your time, that a priority of your time belongs to God? And when we take what is God's, we're really worshiping whatever we substitute it with. And so we take from God and we substitute it with entertainment or sports or hunting or whatever. Whatever you put in that place. Here is God. I'm going to put this in the place where God is. That is idolatry, my friend. When we don't worship God, it is because we've replaced him. We've put something else there. Like Eve in the garden, I believe Gomer believed some lies. I believe she believed that seeking material, physical things would thrill her to no end. I believe she believed that there was a God who is better than Jehovah God. Lies. All lies. And I would propose to you that you and I like believing lies. See, for us to confront the lies about ourself, that's painful sometimes. We have to embrace our sinfulness. We have to embrace who we are. We have to turn our attention purposefully again and again to God Almighty. To acknowledge the lies that Satan tells us and that we like believing because it's an easier path for us. And so we'd rather believe the lies. And that makes us God's adulterous wife. Holy Father, may this old story have new truth. And even as we're going to look next week at your love and your mercy, as we examine the first three chapters of this book from the eye and mind of Hosea and you, God, I pray that this morning we may look at ourselves and see ourselves as willingly embracing lies and therefore purposely departing from our God. Heads bowed, eyes closed, here's your invitation. My question is this: what do you worship? Is it stuff? Is it entertainment? Is it praise? Is it sex? Is it some grand achievement? What do you worship? What consumes your thoughts? Is it God?